You know, sometimes you just got so many pieces of paper, you don't get to them all. Well, I need to read something else before I get into the message. I was supposed to do this last week and left it on my desk last Wednesday night. And so this is a little thank you from Brother Doug Johnson. You know, his sister passed away. And so let me read this. Just wanted to use this space to give thanks to God for our church family and for all the members who shook my hand and expressed their sympathy in the loss of my sister, Sandra Holloway, for all the prayers during her long battle with cancer, for the visits from our church's pastor, associate pastor, and deacon at the funeral home. Also, thank you all for coming to the funeral. I appreciate the beautiful sympathy card from our church family and the bass guitar player. He's talking about Brother Pierce. Brother Doug came to the funeral home. And please keep Sandra's children and grandchildren in your prayers as they mourn and adjust to life without their mother and grandmother. And so please pray for the Johnson family. Well, I call your attention tonight to the Gospel of Matthew to begin with. I want you to go to Matthew chapter 14, and that's where we will begin tonight. Matthew 14. And then we're going to go to Mark chapter 6. We are on another miracle of Jesus. This miracle is one that is not really preached on a whole lot. As a matter of fact, it happens about a year before Jesus is crucified. It's probably sometime in maybe the spring of 29. And so you've got a kind of a turning point. Jesus is going to do some miracles tonight in our passages, and he's trying to get them to understand something that is hard for people to understand. And what that is that physical healing and physical food, those are not the things that really matter. The things that matter are eternal. And so in Matthew 14, verse 34, it says, "And when they were gone over, they came into the land of Gennesaret. And when the men of that place had knowledge of him, they sent out into all that country round about and brought unto him all that were diseased, and besought him that they might only touch the hem of his garment." We've heard that before when we preached the message on the lady that had the issue of blood. All she wanted to do was touch the hem of his garment. "And as many as touched were made perfectly whole." One of the things about the healings of Jesus that you always notice is that when he heals, it's not partial. When a man that's a paralytic, when he gets healed, it's not that one leg works and the other one doesn't. No, both legs work. When he heals a man that is blind, he sees out of both eyes, not one eye. You always find the healings to be complete. And so the title of the message tonight comes from the last two words in verse 36, perfectly whole. And when people get healed of the disease of sin, they are perfect in the eyes of the Lord. They are justified. That is a word which means just as if I had never sinned. We can stand before God and him look at us, and it's as though we were as pure as a fresh snow in its cleanness. And so, perfectly whole is the title of the message tonight. Now, our passage for this evening comes from the Gospel of Mark. Go to Mark chapter 6, and that's where we will spend the remainder of our time tonight. In Mark chapter 6, look with me beginning at verse 53. And when they had passed over, where's passed over? Passed over the Sea of Galilee, all right? They came into the land of Gennesaret and drew to the shore. And when they were come out of the ship, straightway or immediately, they knew him and ran through that whole region round about and began to carry about in beds those that were sick, where they heard he was. And whithersoever he entered into villages or cities or country, they laid the sick in the streets and besought him, they begged him, that they might touch, if it were but the border of his garment. In other words, they just, even if it was just a little bitty touch, if they could just get to the border of that garment, that's all that it was needed. And if they could do that, as many as touched him were made whole. The background in our passage tonight is very simple. Jesus and his disciples are tired. There's no doubt about that. The strains of ministry has really kind of gotten to them a little bit. It hasn't been but just a few days, and John the Baptist has had his head cut off just a few days ago. Herod took one of the best men. As a matter of fact, Jesus said, there's never been a better man than John the Baptist that's born of a woman. And he took this good man, and because of a lust-filled promise that he made, he had to cut his head off. Well, he didn't have to, but he chose to. And so they have that they're dealing with. And then just the day before, what do you have? You've got Jesus. He's trying to get to a place of seclusion, and 5,000 men. They know where he's at. They take their families and they all go, and probably somewhere around 20,000 people, they find Jesus, and he's outside of this city of Capernaum, kind of on a hill, and he feeds them because the sun is setting. It's probably between 3 and 6 o'clock when they finally receive food. It's the first even. It's too late for them to buy bread. And so Jesus begins to take those little barley loaves and those two fish, and he begins to break those and pass them out. And the more he breaks, the more there is. And so they've done that work. They're trying to rest, but they're working. Then he sends them away, and he says to his disciples, you go back to Capernaum and I'll meet you there. And what happens that night? In the second even, it's what I preached on last week. Whenever they began that journey, it was only 5 miles. They were going to let the sail just blow them across the Sea of Galilee. The only problem was, as they got out into that lake, the wind was contrary, and they dropped the sail, and they began to get the oars out, and they began to try to row. They began to try to take themselves across that lake, a 5-mile trek, and it says that they rowed from that late even, which is about 30 minutes after sunset, until about 3 o'clock in the morning. These men could have easily been rowing for 7 or 8 hours. And where are they at? They're only halfway across that lake. And the storm is bad. I mean, you've got Florence coming in on the Sea of Galilee. The waves are coming over. The wind is against them. And they're thinking, we're going to die. And then all of a sudden, somebody sees a figure coming this way, and it's the Lord. And then Peter says, let me come out there. He gets out of the boat. He walks. He begins to look. He sees and feels the wind. And all of a sudden, boom, he sinks. Jesus saves him. They walk back into the boat together. And immediately they're on the shore, and it's daylight. And now it's the time to get back in the boat. And where are they going? Now they're coming to our passage tonight. They're coming to the place or the land of Gennesaret. And so they're tired. They're thinking maybe we'll get a little bit of rest now. But no, that's not what's going to happen. The first thing that I want you to see is I want you to see the arrival. Look at verse number 53. And when they had passed over, they came into the land of Gennesaret and drew to the shore. I want you to notice that this place that they went to, it was a countryside. It was not really a metropolitan type area. Gennesaret was more of a region. It was not really a city. You had little villages that would dot the landscape. It was located between Capernaum and then around a little bit on the Sea of Galilee. There's another place called Magdala. Does anybody have any idea what Magdala was all about? Anybody remember a lady named Mary Magdalene? She was from Magdala. And so this place that Jesus is now at is about halfway between his home base of Capernaum and Magdala. And so it's secluded, it's little towns, but Jesus is recognized. There's no doubt this little place, which was known because of its farmland, Josephus said that it was a place that was known for walnuts, it was known for palm trees, it was known for olives, it was known for grapes. It was just basically a very fertile area. And I can imagine it being that way just simply because it's close to a fresh water supply. And so you've got this little countryside. He thinks they're going to maybe get away, or the disciples at least think they're going to get away. And so when you look at that, you think, well, all right, is it secluded? Is it going to be where he can rest? No, not really. In the Old Testament, this place was known to the tribe of Naphtali. This was one of the 12 tribes of Israel. The book of Joshua tells us about this place. It's the area in the Old Testament called Chinnereth. And the reason that they called it that was because of the shape of this lake. And the shape of the Sea of Galilee, if you took a kind of a bird's eye view from way up and you looked down on it, it would remind you of a harp, an old-time harp that would have strings across it, and you can see the outline of that if you looked at a picture of it from high up. And so we see that it's a fruitful land, but may I say that just because a place is fruitful or a place is prosperous, that doesn't mean there's not sick people there. You know, when you go to a hospital, you got all kind of folks that are in that hospital. One of the things that was amazing to me years ago, over at Emory, they have one whole wing that was renovated by a man that was wealthy. And I remember one day Brother Don and I were visiting at Emory, and we went into this particular hallway, and the hospital room was something that you would see basically at like a 4 or 5 star hotel. I mean, it was nice solid wood furniture. The bed was huge. Then there was a kitchen off to the side of it. There was another room for the family to sleep so they could stay there at night and didn't have to sleep in a chair. And as I'm going in there, I'm thinking, man, there's people all around the world that would love to live in this place. And here it is, it's a hospital room. And what is it for? It's for people that are willing to pay extra. But may I say that just because you have money don't mean you don't get sick. And the sweet lady that we were visiting, ultimately, she passed on to glory, and she's with the Lord. And she was a faithful worker in this church for 40 plus years. And she's been with Jesus now for quite some time, but I never forgot what that room in that hallway looked like. I think there's only been one other time in 40 years of visitation at Emory that I've ever seen that hallway other than that one time. I think maybe one other. And so even wealthy people get sick. And so it's a fertile place, it's a materialistic place, but there's still illness that's there. Do you know there's probably no place in the whole world, and I mean that literally, I don't care what part of Europe you go to, I don't care if you go even to the country of Israel, and they have made advancements beyond belief in their medical research and their care for medicine in the country of Israel. There's no place in the world that is better than America. You have people in Canada that forget that socialized medicine, they come to America to have stuff done. And so this is the greatest country in the world when it comes to our health care. But we still have people that get sick. We just went over a whole list of people. There are people that are going to have surgery tomorrow. There's people that have had surgery. There's people that are going to have surgery. There's people that are sick. There's people that are having biopsies. All of that. And some of these people are not poor by any stretch. Now, they may not be uber wealthy, but materially, they're set. But they're sick. And so we see the arrival of Jesus. The second thing that I want you to see tonight is I want you to see that the news begins to spread. Look with me at verse 54. And when they were come out of the ship, and by the way, again, the ship there is a boat that's about as long as the pew that maybe Miss Aline and Charlotte are sitting on. It's enough to put 12 or 14 people in if they're sitting shoulder to shoulder. And it's not a very big boat. They probably would not pass, the Coast Guard's, requirements. They might not have had a life jacket. They might have all had a piece of wood to hang on to. But the bottom line is they were all in a boat that was barely big enough for them to all be in. But yet that's what they were traveling across that lake in. It was not a ship like the cruise ships. And so straightway, they, the people of Gennesaret, of that region, they knew him. Somebody says, well, how in the world would they know him? People had given story after story after story. You think about all the people that had been healed by Jesus up to this point. Tonight, I think this is number 21. I didn't check it today, but I think it's miracle 21 out of our maybe 35 or 36 that we're going to be doing. And so we've had at least 20 other miracles that has taken place, and some of them have not been too far from here. You've got folks and their travel around that lake. They've heard of what's happened over in Capernaum. They may have even known some of the people that got healed outside of Peter's house the night after his mother-in-law got healed. And so word spreads like wildfire about things that happen that Jesus does. And so, it's almost like a New Testament time Paul Revere. You remember the story of Paul Revere? You know how that they went through all of the little towns up in Concord and all of those places, and the British are coming. Well, this is kind of like what's happened. If you look, it says that they ran. In other words, they're not nonchalant about this. They're getting the word out. Why? Because somebody that can help them is in the area. Well, he's recognizable. He's a celebrity. And it did not matter where he went, they came. If you look at the latter part of verse 55, what did they do? They carried those on beds. that were sick, where they heard he was. No matter where he was at. I mean, if he were a half a mile that way, they would say, let's go. And it's just like the four men that took their friend on that bed and had him let down through the ceiling of that house. You got people that are carrying people with their beds. I don't know if they're dragging them like they do in Westerns or if they got people carrying them like they did over whenever we read that story in Luke. But the bottom line is, there are people that are carrying their friends and their neighbors to Jesus, and wherever he's at, if they get over there and he's not there and he's moved over to some other little village, then they follow him over there. And finally they catch up to him. And what do they want? They want one thing. They want to be able to just touch the hem of his garment. Now that tallit was basically a prayer shawl. I want you to think of a shawl that would just simply go around your shoulders, but it would be bigger than probably a beach towel, but not much. Just think of something that maybe was as long as a beach towel, but maybe a little bit wider than a beach towel. But on each corner, there would be little tassels that would hang down. And on those tassels, there would be little blue threads. And what that would do is that would remind the people in the Old Testament about heaven. The white prayer shawl, that was to symbolize the holiness, the cleanness, the righteousness of God. And so you would have these little blue tassels that would have these strings. And by the way, there were some of these that were quite expensive. And certain historical writings, they would tell about how that people would get the blue dye before synthetic dyes came along. There was one snail that they would have to capture or somehow they would have to catch out of the ocean. And they would take that little snail and they would mash him, and there would be a blue that would come out of him. But it would take literally hundreds of these. And so they estimated that in today's dollars, it would be like $36,000 for a process to be able to make one of these in an old-fashioned way. And so they had the blue that would be representative of heaven. But then each one of those would have a knot tied in it. And on all four of the corners, the total of knots would amount to exactly 613. The reason for that is because there are 613. There you go. All right. I didn't know Darryl was going to help me preach tonight. Okay. But anyway, you can see these knots that are tied right here. And if that's blue, that's a navy blue. But anyway, there's 613 of those knots. And each one of those knots represent one of the laws in the Mosaic law. And so these men would put this around themselves like this, and this is what they would wear. Well, when they would wear it like that, what they would do is they would, first of all, let people know that they were religious, and this was to be a reminder that they were to think of God and they were to walk in the ways of God, because God was always watching. And is that not a good lesson for us? That no matter where we go, what we do, that the eyes of the Lord are upon us. And so they would have that they would do. Also, I remember when Brother Sexton preached on a tallit one time, he said that they would cover their heads and they would do this. And what that was, that is where you would be in your prayer closet. In other words, you didn't literally go over. You didn't go over to a room like in your bedroom, open up the door, go into a closet where your clothes are at, shut the door, and that's where you prayed. No, to the ancient Jews, what they would do, they would take their tallit and they would throw it over their head, and that way nothing would distract them. Now, one of the things that we have happen in our church, just like other churches do, you have things that happen in front of you that distract you. If you get to church early, let's say on a Sunday, and you get to the back seat, and then everybody fills in front of you, you can see people moving, you can see people talking, you can see, you know, people falling over, you can see all kind of stuff. Why? Because you're observing what's going on, and you're looking at the preacher, or you're looking at the singer, but all these things that you're seeing peripherally comes into play. But if you cover your head, there's nothing to distract. And so you go into your prayer closet, and so Jesus has a tallit, and as he's walking by, they see these little tassels hanging down, and they know, because of his reputation, he's a man of God. As a matter of fact, with what they are asking, it's something else. Now hold your place here in Mark 6, and I want you to go with me to Malachi chapter 4. I want you to look with me at Malachi 4. Look at verse number 2. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise. That is a messianic title. That is a title for Messiah. The Greeks would say that's a title for Christ. And so it's a title of Messiah. And what does it say? He will arise with healing in his wings. The wings here in Malachi 4 is not bird's wings. He's not going to be flying around like an eagle. It's the wings of his tallit. And so these people in Matthew and these people in Mark, if we can but touch the hem, the tallit of his garment, there's healing there. And so that's why they ask for that. Now let's go back to Mark chapter 6. These people knew about Messiah, but what were they wanting to have him do? Well, you can read story after story when Jesus would heal. Whenever we did the miracle 2 weeks ago, what did they want to do after he fed them? Let's make him a king. And finally, Jesus said, no, everybody leave. Disciples, go to Capernaum. You guys, leave. And he goes off by himself. Why? Because he knew that they wanted to make him the king at that moment. And you got 5,000 men, and that's a standing army already in a little place like Israel. I mean, these guys are ready to grab clubs, and they're ready to grab hoe handles, and they're ready to grab pruning hooks, and they're saying, hey, let's go fight the Romans. But that's not what Jesus was about. And so he sends them away before they can get to him and do that. And he gets his disciples out of harm's way by putting them in a boat and saying, go to Capernaum and I'll meet you there. But yet these people, they want to be healed physically. They want the material touch. Now we do too. You know, I don't want us to be hypocritical tonight and say all we care about is the spiritual. If that were so, we wouldn't talk about let's pray for so-and-so that's about to have open heart surgery. If all we cared about was the spiritual, we wouldn't talk about somebody that just got diagnosed with some terminal illness. We wouldn't think about those things because that would not be on our minds, because we'd be thinking spiritual things. And these people are the same way. They want to physically be better. And you and I want to be physically better. But the bottom line is, it's about spiritual things primarily. Let's face it, when Lazarus got raised from the dead, and we'll get to him one of these days before long, when he got raised from the dead, can I tell you something? Lazarus died again. You know, when the woman that was healed of the issue of blood, can I tell you something? Ultimately, she died. And we can be healed of all kind of things, but ultimately, the healing that is going to last is when we get to heaven. Because we're not going to have sinful bodies any longer. These old sinful bodies that we got, they just cause all kind of problems. I got up the other day. I was over at a business. I got up, and when I did, the three or four things cracked, and a lady walking by said, "I do the same thing." And I thought, well, I guess it's going to be that way till Jesus comes or I die. But I did. I got up, and it's like crack, crack, crack. And she goes, "You know, I do the same thing." And it's just going to get worse. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about right now because you've already passed the crack, crack, crack. Now you sound like Snap, Crackle, and Pop cereal. It's pop, 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 all right? And so the ultimate healing is going to be when the Lord comes and we get a glorified body or we go to heaven and there's no more sin that reigns in our bodies. But these people, they wanted a Messiah to set up his kingdom at this moment, but that was not the plan of God. And so, what did Jesus do? Well, he healed them. Jesus has compassion. Even when people misunderstand, he still loves people. And so, if they touched him, if they were able to at least touch that little tallit, the scriptures tell us here in Mark that they were made whole. And in Matthew it said that they were perfectly whole. And so we see that when he came, he still had compassion. Now let me give you one final thing tonight and then we'll have a short business meeting. Third thing, look at verse 56. "And whithersoever ever he entered into villages or cities or country, they laid sick in the streets." That means in every street, in every village, there were people that needed help. Now let that sink in for a moment. Every village, every street, there were people that were sick and they needed help. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that in every town that we go in, every street we go down, there's people that need Jesus. When the Lord prompts us to witness to somebody, we ought to do it. When I was a Bible college student, I would hear preachers say things like this: "If I don't witness to that person, he may die and go to hell that night." But can I tell you that I never knew of anybody that died and didn't get a chance to hear again? Until Sunday. I mean, I really believe that somebody, if you didn't witness, they could die, but I just never knew of anybody. Perhaps you do, but I never did. Not that I could recall until I heard Sunday. After I preached Sunday, there was a visiting preacher that was here. He comes maybe once every 2 months, Preston Moore. And as I was walking out, he said, "Preacher, that was a really good message today." He said, "Can I tell you a story?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I was pastoring over in Stone Mountain on the other side of the mountain, kind of. And he said, there was a man in the community, and he was a good man. He was a kind man. He was a compassionate man. He was a generous man. But he wasn't saved. And he said, I was going by his house one day, and God spoke to me just as clearly, 'You need to go and talk to that man about the Lord.' And he said, but I was in a hurry, and I didn't do it. And I just simply made the excuse, I'll do it later. But he said, there was no doubt God told me to do that, and I didn't. He said, I went on by his house. An hour later, I was coming back, and as I got next to the man's house, I looked, and the house was engulfed in flames. And I stopped, and his daughter, who I knew, came rushing out, and she said, Oh, preacher, Daddy's gone. He was in the house, and he's dead. And he said, I never got over that. And he said, from that day until now, if God has ever spoken to me that clearly again, he said, I've done what I was supposed to do. And all I'm thinking is, that's a pretty hard burden to bear right there. If God has told you to do something, God has told you to talk to somebody, and you don't do it, and then something happened. I remember reading the story about a father and daughter that had become estranged from each other. She had begun to see a young man that he didn't particularly care for, and they had begun to fuss about it, and they had said some things to each other, and basically the girl just left home. She married, didn't work out. They ended up divorcing, and she knew that her father was right, but she had too much pride to admit it. Well, somebody called her and told her, they said, your father's in the hospital. He's in intensive care, and they're not expecting him to make it. The mother had already gone. She had already passed on. And the lady that had called her was a nurse from the hospital, and she said, this was the number that I was given. Are you his relative? Yes, I'm his daughter. I'm his only child. She said, well, your father is in bad shape. He may not make it. And she told the nurse, she said, don't let him die. Don't let him die. Don't let him die. The last thing that I said to him was basically, you're not running my life. I hate you. I'm going to do what I want to do. She said, well, you need to hurry. And said she got in her car and she drove as quickly as she could to the hospital. And as she got there, she saw that all the lights were off down in that hallway, and finally she got into the room and her father had already died. And she began to cry. And she was sitting there in a chair with her hands over her eyes and on her face. And the nurse that had called her came in and said, are you so-and-so? And she said, yes. And she said, I didn't get a chance to tell him. I didn't get a chance to tell him. And she said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, the last thing that we said to each other were harsh words. And I told him that I hated him, that he wasn't going to run my life. And she said, I wanted to tell him that I was sorry that he was right. And she said, well, he died peaceably. She said, but he did leave you this note. She handed her a note. She looked at it, and she began to weep again. And he called her name, and he said, basically, he said, forgive me, and I forgive you. And her dad was okay. He was a Christian. She was going to be okay because she was a Christian. And when she got that note, she was relieved that her father was okay with it. But what about if her dad had not been a Christian? What about if her dad would have been unsaved? And now she's got to go through the rest of her life knowing that the last thing she said to her father was harsh. How much greater would it be if we had to go through life going, knowing that we were supposed to witness to somebody and we didn't? Should we be concerned about physical things? Sure. If we knew somebody was starving tonight, there'd be somebody in this church that'd say, let me go get them something to eat. There's not a family in this church, if they did not have food on the table, that would not have something before an hour and a half after this service was over tonight if we knew about it. But the bottom line is, all of that's temporal. The most important thing is salvation and heaven. But these folks didn't care about that. This is a turning point in the ministry of Jesus. He's been on an incline going up with popularity. But when he begins to tell them, it's not all about food. It's not all about healing. It's about the kingdom of God. His popularity begins to do this. There'll be one little surge as he comes into Jerusalem on what's called that Triumphal Monday. But the bottom line is, it's not but a couple of 3 days later, and the next thing you know, they got him nailed to a cross. And so they're made perfectly whole, but there's more important things than being perfectly whole physically. It's being saved and getting other people saved, because that matters for eternity. Father, I want to thank you for a good night tonight. I pray that you'll take this message, drive it home, and I pray that tonight that you would be honored with what we do with our business meeting. In Christ's name, amen. Well, tonight.